content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated December 7th, 2012. And as usual, we'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article today is entitled, Egypt Erupts Over Morsi's Power Play. Here's what happened. Hundreds of thousands of Egyptians staged protests in Cairo and other major cities this past week, demanding that President Mohamed Morsi rescind a constitutional decree granting himself autocratic powers. In the capital, some 200,000 secular demonstrators against Morsi's Islamist government converged on Tahrir Square, chanting, "The people want the fall of the regime," the same slogan shouted last year in opposition to longtime dictator Hosni Mubarak. And in the cities of Alexandria, Mahalla, and Mansoura, angry crowds of anti-Morsi demonstrators attacked the headquarters of the Muslim Brotherhood, the powerful Islamist group Morsi led until his election 5 months ago. The demonstrators were sparked when Morsi decreed that all of his presidential policies were immune from judicial review and banned the courts from dissolving an Islamist-dominated legislative panel that is writing a new constitution. "We hoped he would be different from Mubarak," said Gauda Ali Hassan, a protester in Tahrir Square. "He can't declare himself another pharaonic god and expect us to be silent." Morsi and the Brotherhood insisted that the decree was necessary to protect the Arab Spring Revolution from the judiciary and promised that once full constitutional democracy was established, the president would relinquish these powers. Obama administration officials expressed concern over the declaration, but noted that Morsi has taken a conciliatory tone in response to the protests and was meeting with judges and the opposition. "That's a far cry from an autocrat just saying, my way or the highway," said State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland. Now here's what the editorial said. "Morsi's frustration with the judges is understandable," said the Washington Post. "The Mubarak appointees on the Supreme Court already dismissed a democratically elected parliament on a technicality earlier this year and were threatening to block the writing of a new constitution and perhaps to tip the country back toward chaos. But Morsi's reaction to this deadlock was a huge overreach, especially given the fear of Egypt's secular youth that Islamists would turn the country into another Iran. Instead of protecting a revolution, Morsi now risks triggering one." "The military won't intervene to topple Morsi," said the Wall Street Journal. "Egypt's powerful generals are only interested in protecting their great wealth, power, and privilege, and the Brotherhood's draft constitution puts the military outside of civilian control. This is a recipe for rule a la Pakistan, with an increasingly Islamist state, but the military and intelligence services as an independent power." Now here's what the columnist had to say. "Nobody should be surprised by this power grab," said Jonah Goldberg in the Chicago Tribune. "Naive Westerners have been calling Morsi a moderate, but since his election, this cunning Islamist ideologue has deftly built the foundation for despotism. He's replaced military leaders with officers more pliable to the Brotherhood, purged scores of newspaper editors, and put himself in charge of the new constitution. President Obama helped create this monster," said Patrick Brennan in NationalReview.com. "His administration has come to rely on the Egyptian leader as its Middle East interlocutor. most recently asking him to broker a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. Mercy knows the U.S. wants him as an ally, not as an enemy, one reason he felt secure enough to make this power grab. Fears that Mercy is a budding dictator are exaggerated, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. He and Islamist legislators were elected by a majority of the Egyptian people, but the unelected judiciary, stocked with allies of the old military order, has in effect been trying to stage a constitutional coup d'etat. Mercy's attempts to defang the obstructionist court were naive and they backfired badly. Now he has to prove to Egyptians and to the world that his goal is democracy, not dictatorship. Hopes for Egyptian democracy are not dead, said David Rode in TheAtlantic.com, but the ongoing chaos there could lead to a return to the kind of dictatorship that the U.S. supported for years for the sake of stability. The U.S. and the West should make it clear that our billions in aid will be cut off through Mercy or anyone else claim unilateral power. If Egyptians squander their chance for democracy, it's their choice. Shame on us, though, if we lose our nerve and make the strong man mistake twice. The next item from The Week magazine, Susan Rice goes to the Hill. Republican senators stepped up their campaign against UN Ambassador Susan Rice this past week after she met with them in an attempt to defuse their claim that she intentionally misled the public about the September attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Rice, considered President Obama's first choice to replace Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, said on September 16th that the attack had been a spontaneous assault by extremists, when it was in fact a planned raid by al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. The CIA has said that it gave Rice talking points that made no mention of local al-Qaeda links in order to protect Libyan sources and its own investigation. But after meeting Rice, the Republican senators said they remain convinced that she spearheaded a pre-election White House cover-up and vowed to block her nomination as Secretary of State. We are significantly troubled by many of the answers that we got and some that we didn't get, said Senator John McCain. For McCain, this feud is personal, said John Heilman in New York Magazine. As one of Obama's most quotable surrogates in 2008, Rice called McCain too dangerous to be president, and payback is unquestionably what's motivating him now. It's also political, said Michael Tomosky in TheDailyBeast.com. The Republicans want Senator John Kerry to be Secretary of State because they believe former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown can win Kerry's vacated seat. One less Democrat in the Senate is almost as attractive as Rice's scalp. We're in danger of getting lost in the sideshows, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Rice did not lie to the country for her own benefit, nor did the CIA. It was to protect Obama, whose policies of appeasing Islamists in Libya left four dead and who sold us the lie that al-Qaeda has been defeated. Congress mustn't let the Rice farrago become a distraction from the truth. It could actually lead us to the truth, said Thomas Schaller in the Baltimore Sun. Even if McCain is playing for the cameras, he is asking important questions about what the White House did before, during, and especially after the attacks. A confirmation hearing for Rice could be contentious and may get ugly, but it would provide the detailed answers we all deserve about this tragic incident and its troubling aftermath. The next item, a strong start for holiday sales this year. Shoppers flocked to malls and spent record sums online over the Thanksgiving weekend, starting the holiday shopping season off at a robust clip. A record 247 million people visited stores or shopped online, and total spending hit an estimated $59.1 billion, 13% more than last year. Online spending on Black Friday alone topped $1 billion for the first time. Cyber Monday sales also set a new record, jumping 20% over last year to $1.5 billion. Some large retailers opened on Thanksgiving Day to entice shoppers with doorbuster deals. Michelle Huff lined up outside a St. Louis area Toys R Us at 1:30 p.m. on Thanksgiving for the store's 8 p.m. opening. It cuts into family time, she said, but shopping early is a tradition. Expanding Black Friday sales into Thanksgiving isn't a smart move for retailers, said Brad Tuttle in Time.com. Store foot traffic was up on Friday over last year, while in-store sales were slightly down, giving credence to the theory that many shoppers were there just for the purposes of browsing and checking out goods they would buy online later. Black Friday and Cyber Monday are pure hype anyway, said Neil Irwin in WashingtonPost.com. Sales over Thanksgiving weekend tell us virtually nothing about retail sales for the full holiday season, let alone anything meaningful about the economy as a whole. The media gets a ready-made story on a slow news weekend, while retailers compete for a few more consumer dollars by waging an opening time arms race. The entire exercise is carefully designed to make you behave like an idiot, said Kevin Roos in NYMag.com. Between retail tricks and your own cognitive flaws, you have almost no chance of actually saving money on these supposed holiday deals. Enduring cold, dark misery for the shot at cheap electronics has become our own nationwide experiment in consumer irrationality, dressed up as cheerful holiday add-on. Consider it a new American tradition. And now from the Week magazine, we'll look at the controversy of the week. This week it's entitled The Fiscal Cliff, which we hear so much about. What if negotiations fail? Elections have consequences, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post, even if the Republicans refuse to admit it. On January 1st, the Bush-era tax cuts are due to automatically expire at the same moment that massive spending cuts that both parties agreed to during the 2011 debt ceiling standoff kick in. All told, $503 billion could be siphoned out of the economy by a plunge off this fiscal cliff, which could throw the still weak U.S. economy back into recession. But as President Obama and the GOP-controlled House of Representatives battled this past week over terms of a compromise deal, it's clear that Obama is in a far stronger position politically. He just decisively won an election framed by his insistence that deficit reduction must involve higher taxes on the wealthy rather than massive cuts in social programs, as Mitt Romney proposed. So weakened is the GOP, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, that House Speaker John Boehner and other Republicans say they'll abandon the famous Grover Norquist pledge never to raise taxes and are open to new revenue. Listen more carefully, said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com. Despite their soothing words about compromise, Republicans are clinging to their refusal to end the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. They're offering to bring in new revenue solely by capping an individual taxpayer's deductions at some arbitrary number, say $25,000 or $50,000, rather than raising the top tax rate beyond its current 35%. Meanwhile, they're demanding major cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Even as an opening bid, this offering is dishearteningly insincere. Obama has already rejected it since a cap on deductions wouldn't meet his goal of $1.6 trillion in new revenue over 10 years. If Republicans won't compromise on tax rates, said Daniel Gross in the DailyBeast.com, Obama should simply let the nation go careening over the cliff on January 1. That's right, some liberals call us the Thelma and Louise Caucus, believe that letting the Bush tax cuts expire and automatic defense cuts kick in would provide great clarity to the whole budget debate. With Clinton-era tax rates back in effect, Republicans would have to defy their sacred no-tax pledge and raise taxes on the top 2%, since the top tax rate would already have reverted to 39.6%. After January 1, the Democrats have all the leverage. As a conservative, I also am in favor of fiscal cliff diving, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post, but it's Obama, not Republicans, who'll lose leverage after January 1, since the president's obsession with raising taxes on the rich will lead to big tax hikes for the other 98% of Americans, too. At that point, Democrats might be less arrogantly triumphant and more willing to consider real reform on our tangled tax code, as well as to rein in the entitlement and social services spending that everybody knows is bankrupting the nation. The time for game playing is over, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The reality is that both Republicans and Democrats will have to compromise, and the agreement they reach, by definition, is going to sit poorly with the fiscal fundamentalists in both parties. To get our ballooning debt under control, we are going to need both higher taxes and entitlement reform. That's the fundamental truth, and if our elected leaders can't face it, the U.S. will take a terrifying tumble over the fiscal cliff. Look out below. And now from the main stories section of the Week magazine, we will turn to the very popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for New York City, where on Monday not a single person was reported shot, stabbed, or murdered. The first time police officials can remember recording no such crimes over a 24-hour period. It was a good week for maintaining possession after New York Giants tight end Martellus Bennett caught a fan who had fallen out of the stands and was dropping 15 feet head first. "Mr. Spidey Senses told me he was going to take a fall," said Bennett, "so I saved his life." And it was a good week for Graham Hughes, a British adventurer who became the first person to visit all 201 nations in the world without flying. Hughes used boats, buses, taxis, trains, and his own 2 feet to travel 160,000 miles in 1,426 days. "I wanted to show that the world is not some big, scary place," Hughes said. It was a bad week for the revolution after the Cuban government instituted its first income taxes in 50 years as part of its free market economy reforms. "They collect taxes all around the world. It's normal," said Havana economist Isabel Fernandez. It was a bad week for taking politics too seriously after a Kentucky high school teacher wrote on the blackboard of her psychology class, "You can't be a Democrat and go to heaven." Officials later apologized. And it was a bad week for hunters after 2 Texas deer hunters were attacked by an apparently revenge-minded buck outside their home. The buck repeatedly charged into the men, climbed into their truck as they tried to flee, and stole their cigarettes and ate them. "I think he tried to hunt us," said frightened hunter Joseph Rose. And now we'll turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine for this week. Our briefing article today is entitled "Women in Congress." Women now hold a record 20% of Senate seats and more than 18% of the House. Why not more? How long has Congress had female members? Women have served in Congress since suffrage activist Jeanette Rankin of Montana won a seat in 1916, 4 years before women won the right to vote. The feminist movement of the 1960s brought in a new wave of Congresswomen, including Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected, and Bella Abzug, one of the first to advocate gay rights. Shirley and Bella were not what the male members of Congress had come to expect from a female colleague, said former Representative Catherine Dean May, who was first elected in 1959. They got just as demanding and as noisy and as difficult as men did. Still, women never made up much more than 2 or 3% of members until the watershed election of 1992, known as the Year of the Woman. And we'll have a footnote about that in a moment. And that was when women's representation doubled. What happened this year? The number of women in the Senate increased from 17 to 20, and in the House from 78 to 80. New Hampshire became the first state to have an all-female congressional delegation, but the gains were limited to Democrats. In the Senate, Democrats grew from 12 women to 16, while Republicans dropped from 5 to 4. In the House, Republican women dropped from 24 to 21. For various policy and sociological reasons, women are more active in the Democratic Party. 190 female Democrats ran for the House this year, compared with 109 Republicans, and the Democratic candidates tended to be better prepared, thanks to well-funded Democratic groups like Emily's List, Emerge, and Progressive Majority, which identify potential candidates and then prep them for the rigors of a campaign. The Republicans have fewer programs to groom female candidates. Still, even the Democrats remain far away from true gender parity. Women competed in fewer than one-third of congressional races this past year. Why don't more women run? It's partly a pipeline problem. Women make up just under 24% of members of state legislatures, a kind of farm system for national candidates. That percentage has been essentially flat for a decade. One reason more women don't run is the same reason there are so few women at the highest level of corporations. Political jobs are so all-consuming that they leave little time for the family. And the higher the office, the more time it consumes. Women tend not to run until after they have had children, by which time they face opponents with more experience. Incumbency is also a huge advantage in American politics, and most incumbents are men. Women's own attitudes about their abilities also hold them back. Studies show that women with the same qualifications as men rate themselves as unqualified for office, a kind of internalized sexism. What else puts them off? The national media coverage of women is clearly a discouraging factor. A survey of potential female candidates showed that the intense reactions to the candidacies of Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin actually scared women off rather than inspiring them to run themselves. Women of both parties said media coverage was too personal, too negative, and too focused on the women's looks. It's still husbands and hemlines, says political scientist Barbara Palmer. On the House floor, women have had to struggle for equal treatment from their male peers. The day I wore a pantsuit onto the floor, you'd have thought I asked for a land base for China, said Pat Schroeder, the first congresswoman from Colorado. Do women do better in other countries? Women generally make up more than 25% of lawmakers in Western European countries. In Sweden, they account for 45%. One reason for their stronger presence is that candidacies in Europe are generally allocated through party lists. Since many parties are committed to maintaining voluntary minimum percentages of women candidates, that process tempers the incumbency bias that skews U.S. contests. Other countries, such as India and Iraq, have mandated quotas for female legislators, but even some without quotas elect far more women than the U.S. In Mozambique, for example, nearly 40% of legislators are women. Do women legislate differently? Studies show that regardless of party affiliation, female legislators are more likely than men to cite the needs of the poor, the sick, the elderly, and children as priorities. But other research suggests that it takes a critical mass of female lawmakers to significantly reshape policy. In decision-making bodies at all levels, from school boards to corporate boards and legislatures, women tend to be interrupted more often and challenged more aggressively than men. Studies show, as a result, they tend to speak less and introduce fewer motions. Only when women make up more than half of the group does that dynamic change. That kind of change is still far off. Don't take the success of this particular cycle for granted, says Sam Bennett of the Women's Campaign. This is the toughest country in the world for women to ascend in politics. And the footnote that I mentioned earlier in this reading, The Real Year of the Woman. The breakthrough year for women in politics was 1992, thanks to Anita Hill, or rather the male senators who grilled her. Hill was the lawyer who in 1991 accused Clarence Thomas of sexually harassing her while he was her supervisor. At the Senate hearings to confirm Thomas as a Supreme Court justice, a phalanx of male senators expressed sneering disbelief that sexual harassment existed at all, dismissing Hill's testimony that Thomas repeatedly propositioned her and made lewd remarks as the delusional rantings of a spurned woman. Women were infuriated and motivated. 1 year later, more women tried for national office than ever before. 39 women ran for open seats and 22 won. This year, 26 women ran in open seat elections and 14 won. I really felt that we were paving the way for a huge number of women, said 1992 Senate candidate Jean Lloyd-Jones of Iowa, but the promise of 1992 was never realized. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week, December 7th, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the best columns in the U.S. The first one is entitled The GOP's Central Dilemma, and it was written by Ramesh Ponnuru in the National Review. Mitt Romney was not the cause of the electoral catastrophe that just befell the Republican Party, said Ramesh Ponnuru. Indeed, election results show that the Republican Party was a drag on him. He outperformed the GOP's losing Senate candidates, many of whom were more overtly conservative than Romney. Republicans got drubbed in this election for one principal reason, the absence of a middle-class message. Our story on how societies prosper has focused on the heroic entrepreneur stifled by taxes and regulations, an important story with which most people do not identify. Most voters see themselves as embattled members of a middle class that struggles to make paychecks cover bills, get decent health care, and send their kids to good schools. About this person, Republicans have had little to say. Indeed, with their exclusionary rhetoric about takers and makers, Republicans have played into the perception that the GOP only serves the interests of the rich. Until we can explain convincingly how smaller government and traditional values will improve the lives of the average working family, we'll continue to lose elections. The next column in the Week magazine, Petraeus's Inevitable Comeback by Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. General David H. Petraeus is about to break the land speed record for rehabilitation from a scandal, said Doyle McManus, just weeks after he resigned as CIA director over an extramarital affair with his biographer Paula Broadwell. The general has entertained an avalanche of opportunities for his next big job. Four universities want him to teach, and corporate boards are calling him. He might hit the lecture circuit, write a book, or go on TV, and a return to public service isn't out of the question, said a friend. Petraeus, a famous overachiever, sees himself as Secretary of Defense or State in a future administration. First, the general still has penance to serve, but he's likely to reap the benefits of the Bill Clinton rule. Adultery is no longer a disqualifier in American politics. Even the thrice-married Newt Gingrich, a repeat adulterer, recently ran for president as a Republican after publicly regretting his mistakes. We're not France, where the public shrugs off official infidelity, but we're no longer Puritan America either. Petraeus's comeback will prove how much we've changed. And the third column, How Airport Security Costs Lives, written by Charles Kenny in Bloomberg Businessweek. Want to save American lives? Stop wasting billions on airport security, said Charles Kenny. Set up in the panicky aftermath of 9/11, the Transportation Security Administration now spends $8 billion a year on intrusive searches, backscatter machines, and other time-consuming security operations that have turned air travel into an ordeal. Is this level of scrutiny still necessary? In recent years, the TSA has not spotted a single terrorist trying to board an airline, and more Americans have died in bathtub accidents than through terrorism. Meanwhile, the unpleasant intrusions and long delays caused by airport security have led to an estimated 5% reduction in passenger volume, as people elect to drive to their destinations rather than to fly, a trend with lethal costs. A Cornell University study concluded that the switch from air to road transportation has led to 242 additional traffic fatalities per month. This means that a lot more people died on the roads as an indirect result of 9/11 than died from being on the planes that terrible day. It's time to put our fear of terrorism in rational perspective and stop chasing people away from airports. Airport security is killing us. And now we'll flip to the back of the week magazine this week for The Last Word. And this week, the title of The Last Word column, which I think you will enjoy, is called Why We're Speaking British. Blame Harry Potter and Tina Brown, says Cordelia Hebblewaite, for our infatuation with Britspeak. Spot on! It's just ludicrous, snaps Jeffrey Nunberg, a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. You are just impersonating an Englishman when you say spot on. And don't get him started on the phrase chattering classes, with its overtones of a distinctly British class system. But not everyone shares his revulsion at the drip, drip, drip of Britishisms, to use an American term, crossing the Atlantic. I enjoy seeing them, says Ben Yagoda, professor of English at the University of Delaware and author of the forthcoming book, How to Not Write Bad. It's like a bird watcher. If I find an American saying one, it makes my day. Last year, Yagoda set up a blog dedicated to spotting the use of British terms in American English. So far, he has found more than 150 of them, from cheeky to chat up via sell by date and the long game, an expression that appears to date back to 1856 and comes not from golf or chess, but the card game whist. President Barack Obama has used the phrase in at least one speech. Yagoda notices changes in pronunciation, too. For example, his students sometimes use that sort of London glottal stop, dropping the T in words like important or Manhattan. Corey Stamper, associate editor for Merriam-Webster, whose dictionaries are used by many American publishers and news organizations, agrees that more and more British words are entering the American vocabulary. Stamper is one of the powerful few who get to choose which words are included in the dictionary, as well as write the definitions for them. One new entry into the Merriam-Webster Dictionary in 2012 was gastropub, a gentrified pub serving good food, which was first used, according to Stamper, in London's Evening Standard newspaper in 1996 and was first registered on American shores in 2000. The British pub is a very different critter from an American bar, she says, but bars with good beer and food are springing up in many cities in the U.S., and the British term is sometimes used to describe them. Twee, meaning excessively dainty or cute, is another word of the moment, says Stamper, as is metrosexual, a well-groomed and fashion-conscious heterosexual man, which took off like wildfire after it was used in the American television series Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. There was even a backlash against it, a sure sign, she says, that the word had absolutely made its way into the American vernacular. There has always been a huge uptick, says Stamper, in the use of ginger as a way of describing someone with red hair. She sees this as clearly tied to the publication in the U.S. of the first Harry Potter book. Unlike in the U.K., there is no anti-ginger prejudice in the U.S., she says. Americans think of warm, comforting things like gingerbread. Dozens of words and phrases were changed for the American market, but ginger slipped through, as did snog, meaning to kiss amorously, though that has not proved so popular. There are other Britishisms that have now become common, like sell-by date. Americans use expiration date for the British sell-by date, the date by which supermarket food must be sold. But sell-by date is increasingly used in the U.S. in a figurative sense. For example, that idea is well past its sell-by date. Then there's chat up, referring to flirtatious conversation, which really began to take off in the 1990s, says Stamper. Often you can't pinpoint why a word or phrase gets picked up, she says. Chat up is a good example of a Britishism that has snuck in on cat's feet. We are not seeing a radical change to the American language, says Jesse Scheidlauer, American editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary, rather a very small but noticeable trend. Bill Kretschmar, professor of English at the University of Georgia, makes a similar point that while the spike in the use of some British terms may look dramatic, it is often because they are rising from a very low base. Most are used very infrequently, he says. And it is not so much the masses who use these terms, says Nunberg, as the educated elite. Journalists and other media types, like advertising agencies, are the worst offenders, in his view. The words trickle down rather than trickle up, he says. It sounds trendy, another borrowing we could use without, to use a British term. It just sounds kind of transatlantic. But the line between trendy and pretentious is a fine one, says Scheidlauer. Anyone who says bespoke, as Americans sometimes do when referring to a custom-made suit, is just showing off. But some British terms can be useful, he adds, filling in a gap where there is no direct equivalent in American English. He cites one-off, something that is done or made or that happens only once, as an example. To go missing is another useful term, says Yagoda, as it is more nuanced, conveying a greater sense of uncertainty than the standard to disappear. Its use climbed significantly in 2001 with the high-profile case of the missing intern Chandra Levy in Washington, D.C. British TV shows like Top Gear, Doctor Who, and Downton Abbey may be another reason for British words slipping into, says Yagoda, as well as the popularity and easy access via the Internet of British news sources such as The Guardian, The Economist, The Daily Mail, and the BBC. He also points to a number of British journalists who have risen to influential positions in the U.S., including Tina Brown, who has worked as editor of Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, The Daily Beast, and Newsweek, and Anna Wintour, editor-in-chief of American Vogue. English, for example, is becoming more international, says Kretschmar, who is also editor-in-chief of the Linguistics Atlas Project, which tracks spoken English. The use of university rather than college or school, for example, may be favored by Americans to make sure they are understood outside the country. The same thing might be influencing a trend that Yagoda has spotted of Americans using the day, month, year format for dates 26, 9, and 12, rather than 9, 26, 12. There is not so much an on and off switch between versions of English, says Kretschmar, but more of a continuum with the same words in existence in different places. Some words, often the more formal ones, were once common on both sides of the Atlantic but dropped out of American English usage while remaining popular in Britain, says Yagoda. Amongst instead of among, trousers instead of pants, and fortnight, 2 weeks, are examples. And some words that Brits regard as typically American, including candy, the fall, and diaper, were originally British, but dropped out of use in Britain between about 1850 and the early 1900s, says Stamper. America has always welcomed words from all over, she says. If it doesn't look conspicuously foreign, I don't think anyone questions. It's just English at that point. The word gormless, the American equivalent is probably clueless, is on the rise in the U.S., for example, says Stamper, but no one thinks of it as a British word. For some reason, it sounds southern to many American ears. There would have been no difference between British and American English when the Pilgrims first crossed the Atlantic. It took time for the two to go their separate ways, a process given a jolt by Noah Webster, who published the first dictionary of American English in 1806, 30 years after the Declaration of Independence. Webster introduced the distinctive American spellings of words like honor, H-O-N-O-U-R, as compared to H-O-N-O-R, color, also C-O-L-O-U-R instead of C-O-L-O-R, and defense, D-E-F-E-N-C-E rather than D-E-F-E-N-S-E. He also included American words like skunk and chowder. He wanted very much for this budding new nation to have its own language, says Stamper, whose Merriam-Webster dictionary is the modern-day version of Webster's work. If we were not British but American, we needed to have an American language as well. These days, the balance of payments, language-wise, is very much skewed the other way, with the Americanisms used far more in Britain than the other way around, says Nunberg. And though a few people do take umbrage at the use of British words in American English, they are in the minority, says Schildlower. In the UK, the use of Americanisms is seen as a sign that culture is going to hell. But Americans think all British people are posh, so aside from things that are fairly pretentious, no one would mind. And that was written by Cordelia Hebblewaite for the BBC News and reprinted in The Week with permission. Now from The Week magazine, we'll turn to the health and science section. Our first article here is entitled, The Link Between Jobs and Breast Cancer. Jobs that expose women to plastics and man-made chemicals can greatly elevate their chances of developing breast cancer. That's the conclusion of a long-term study of more than 2,000 women in Ontario, which found that those who had worked for at least a decade in the food canning and automotive plastics industries were almost five times as likely as women in other jobs to develop breast cancer. Researchers suspect that chemicals such as bisphenol, a BPA, which is found in food can linings, and phthalates, which are found in other kinds of plastics, are to blame for high instances of cancer among such female factory workers, and they point to pesticide exposure as a possible reason why breast cancer is also elevated for farm workers. BPA and phthalates are thought to increase breast cancer risk by mimicking the hormone estrogen. These workplace chemicals are now present in our air, water, food, and consumer products. Occupational health expert James Brophy of the University of Windsor tells the Toronto Star. The study also found that women who work in bars, casinos, and racetracks had double the risk of breast cancer, perhaps because of exposure to secondhand smoke. About 1 in 8 American women will develop breast cancer during their lifetimes. The next article from the Health and Science section, Misdiagnosing ADHD. The youngest kids in class may not only be a real academic disadvantage, but could also be getting medication they don't need. Icelandic researchers compared the birth dates of nearly 12,000 elementary and middle schoolers to their standardized test scores and noted whether they had been prescribed drugs for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which we call ADHD. They found that children in the youngest third of their class were 90% more likely than the oldest third to score near the bottom on math tests and 80% more likely to do so on language art tests. They were also 50% more likely to receive prescriptions for stimulants to combat ADHD. It may be that the youngest kids in class are just acting according to their age, but their behavior is thought of as symptoms of something else. University of Iceland epidemiologist Helga Zoger tells the New York Times, age-related gaps in test scores and behavioral diagnoses were greatest among children in the lowest grades, but they persisted through the seventh grade and potentially beyond. Previous studies have found that high school students who are the youngest in their class are more than 10% less likely than average to enroll in college. And the health scare of the week, teens' bodybuilding obsession. The quest for big, well-defined muscles is causing a surprising number of teenage boys and girls to adopt extreme diets and take possibly harmful supplements. A new study of middle and high school students shows that roughly 1 in 20 boys and slightly fewer girls have tried steroids. More than a third of the boys surveyed and a fifth of the girls said they had used the protein powder, creatine pills, and other muscle-building supplements, including steroids. We were very alarmed by the high numbers of youth using muscle enhancers, University of Minnesota professor Diane Newmark-Stainer tells Time.com. She says teens are trying to emulate the chiseled and muscular athletes and stars they see in the media. Steroids can stunt growth, increase blood pressure, and cause acne and depression. Other supplements can undermine a balanced diet, which is particularly important in the teen years. We need to move away from the idea of an ideal body shape toward an acceptance of diverse body shapes and sizes, Newmark Stainer says. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Talking Points section here. Our first article is entitled, Filibuster Reform, Forcing Senators to Talk. Harry Reid has a plan to fix the broken Senate, said Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune. The Senate Majority Leader wants to reform the filibuster, the legislative tool that allows the minority party to block legislation and presidential nominees. Originally used only as a last resort, the filibuster once required a nonstop speechifying on the Senate floor to block a vote. But nowadays, all the minority party has to do is file a hold, and the Republican Party has used this blocking tactic at unprecedented 386 times since 2007, requiring the Democrats to amass a 60-vote supermajority to end filibusters on virtually every bill and nomination. Just 2.8% of bills introduced in this Congress have been passed, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial, a record low in modern times. That kind of obstructionism is not what the founders envisioned. Under Reid's plan, senators who wanted to block legislation would have to spend hours and hours talking on the Senate floor, the way Strom Thurmond did in a failed attempt to block the Civil Rights Act of 1957. In the guise of reform, Democrats are making a naked power grab, said Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in HumanEvents.com. The Senate's current rules exist to allow the minority party to check the power of majorities and encourage lawmakers to seek compromise. By unilaterally neutering the filibuster, Democrats would poison party relations, extinguishing the very possibility of compromise. Harry Reid should heed the words of a young senator who said that tampering with the filibuster would change the character of the Senate forever, said Kerry Pickett in the Washington Times. That senator, Barack Obama when the GOP majority sought to change the Senate rules in 2005. Let the Republican chicken littles cry that the sky is falling, said Timothy Noah in TNR.com. Reid's insanely radical rule change would merely require a real commitment of time and energy to bring Senate business to a halt. Provided it could keep talking, the minority would still be free to filibuster to its heart's delight. And believe me, it would, said Jonathan Bernstein in WashingtonPost.com. Once Republicans took to the floor in a valiant, telegenic effort to save the nation from, say, immigration reform, Fox News and the rest of the Republican-aligned media would cheer them on as heroes, rewarding and hardening conservative obstructionism. Beware, Democrats, of what you wish for. The next article is entitled, Rubio, How Old is the Earth? Florida Senator Marco Rubio is either an idiot, says Alex Sates Wild in Salon.com, or running for president. How else to explain why, when GQ magazine asked the rising GOP star how old he thinks the Earth is, Rubio replied, "I'm not a scientist, man." Rubio then waffled for a while about the multiple theories out there before concluding that the question of the Earth's age is one of the great mysteries. Not incidentally, Rubio last week made his first appearance in Iowa, where 68% of Republican caucus-goers are Christian conservatives who believe God created the universe in 6 days just a few thousand years ago. For the record, said Garance Frank Ruta in TheAtlantic.com, all the geological and fossil evidence points to the Earth being 4.54 billion years old. Rubio's frantic dodging of scientific reality demonstrates how biblically literal conservatism continues to hold sway over the GOP. Questions like this are nothing but political booby traps, said Paul Kinger in AmericanSpectator.com. The liberal interviewer had but one goal, to caricature Rubio as a know-nothing Christian extremist, thus minimizing the threat of this bright young Hispanic Republican poses as a possible future presidential candidate. As Rubio himself explained in the interview, questions about the age of the Earth have nothing to do with the gross domestic product or economic growth of the United States. In 2008, candidate Barack Obama was asked a similar question, said Dan Amira in NYMag.com. He replied that he didn't presume to know whether the universe was created exactly as described in the Bible. Does that make Obama a science-denying religious zealot or just a politician? All politicians dodge questions, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. But as president, Obama has been a consistent champion of science, whereas Rubio, as a Florida state legislator, compared the teaching of evolution to communist indoctrination. In other words, Rubio shares the dangerous anti-rational mindset of the far right. So if he becomes president, he'll join those who deny the overwhelming evidence that carbon emissions lead to global warming and that tax cuts don't lead to economic growth. How does America solve its national problems if we close our eyes to evidence? How do we compete with other nations in science and technology if we let creationists dictate what's taught in schools? Rubio's little dodge was symptomatic of a broader problem, one that may set America on a path of inexorable decline. Now we'll take a look at a few shorter columns, articles here from the Talking Point section of the Week magazine as we reach the end of our program for this week. First of all, the number of abortions in the U.S. fell by 5% in 2009, the most recent year for which statistics are available, according to the National Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Experts said that the decline was caused mostly by the growing use of effective contraception, including IUDs, hormone patches, and the pill. American men are weighing in at an average of 196 pounds, 16 pounds more than in 1990, a new Gallup survey has found. The average weight for women jumped 14 pounds to 156 pounds over the same period. Gallup estimates 62% of Americans are either overweight or obese. The four members of the Rolling Stones, who launched their 50th anniversary tour in London last week, are now older, on average, than the nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Charlie Watts, and Ronnie Wood have an average age of almost 69 years, while the justices' average age is nearly 67 years. Americans are moving overseas to find work. Some 6.3 million U.S. citizens are now studying or working abroad, the highest number that has ever been recorded. And one political party now controls the state legislature of 47 states. Half of these legislatures have veto-proof supermajorities, meaning that either Republicans or Democrats can pass legislation without any compromise. Now let's take a look at a section called Wit and Wisdom in the Week magazine that's also in the Talking Point section. The will to succeed is important, but what's more important is the will to prepare. And that was a quote from basketball coach Bobby Knight. He was quoted in the Helena, Montana Independent Record. The next quote, "Why is it that when we talk to God, we are said to be praying, and when God talks to us, we are said to be schizophrenic?" That was a quote from a very funny lady, Lily Tomlin, and she was quoted in the Hanford, California Sentinel. Here's the next quote. "The fates guide him who will. Him who won't, they drag." That's "the fates guide him who will. Him who won't, they drag." And that was a quote from Seneca, quoted in the Village Voice. "Prejudice is a raft onto which the shipwrecked mind clambers and paddles to safety." A quote from the author Ben Hecht. He was quoted in the Associated Press. "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours," said humorist Jerome K. Jerome was quoted in the Wall Street Journal. "Diplomacy is the art of telling plain truths without giving offense," said Winston Churchill. He was quoted in the Weekly Standard. "And our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that really matter," quote of Dr. Martin Luther King. The poll watch for this week, 54% of Americans are dissatisfied with the Obama administration's response to the September attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. 40% say administration officials deliberately tried to mislead the public about terrorist involvement in the attacks, while 54% say the White House believed the statements it made to be true at the time. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.